Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post 40, created and hosted by me, writer and broadcaster Sam Baker. Today's guest, Tracy Ann Oberman, has made a career out of defying expectations. After training as an actor, she went straight to the RSC before deciding to study stand-up so she could switch between comedy and drama. She has starred in Doctor Who, Friday Night Dinner, It's a Sin, amongst many others. But it was when she got the role of Chrissy Watts, Dirty Den's second wife on EastEnders, and sorry kids if you don't know what the hell I'm talking about, that she became a household face and name. But right now, she's breaking more new ground as the first actress to play Shylock in a landmark production of The Merchant of Venice. Shakespeare's classic is transported to 1930s London, and Tracy Ann plays Shylock as a tough, no-nonsense Jewish matriarch inspired by her own grandmother.
I never was brought up in a world where women were second place to men at all. And all credit to my grandfathers and uncles and my dad. It always felt that I could do anything, that the most important thing wasn't whether you were a man or a woman, was actually education. Education was the key to everything. Education could get you out of the slums. And if you had if you could educate yourself, then that was the way out.
Tracy Ann and I Zoomed during a break in rehearsals to talk about the matriarchs that shaped her, refusing to be put in a box, standing up to anti-Semitism. We also discussed making your own opportunities as you get older, in praise of being pushy, the importance of putting your face on, and the power of older women in amazing shoes. Well, let's start by talking about Shylock. Then let's start by talking about the production, and then we can go on to talk about your life and your acting career and growing up. You know, let's talk about the production first.
Well, I'm in the middle of rehearsal, so I'm about to go back in now, literally, and we're about to rehearse the court scene where Shylock is holding on to her contract that Antonio signed, saying that if in the unlikely event that he forfeits on the payment, she has the right to demand a pound of his fair flesh. And it's a really interesting scene when you have Shylock played as a woman, because it's a woman in a very male world, a working class woman in a very male world. And the person who is really out to get her is Portia, who is a woman dressed as a man. So it's almost an entirely male courtroom with a woman pretending to be a man who becomes more manly and misogynistic than the men. So it's an interesting scene to go into. But I always wondered what would happen if you took this play and you turned Shylock into a woman, very much based on my great-grandmother and the big matriarchs in my family who had come from the Pale of Settlements, Fiddler on the Roof territory, those little slum villages in Belarus and the area where they were forced to live, and then suffered huge violence at the hands of Tsar Nicholas and the Cossacks. And my Bubba Annie, as we knew her, you know, was nearly raped at 14. She saw her father nearly being beheaded in these slum villages, and was sent over at 14, 15 to escape these pogroms, and ended up living in Cable Street in a factory, and then in the slum tenements of the East End. But they were so strong, these women, Sam. I mean, I think anybody that, particularly working class friends of mine or immigrant friends, everybody had a strong, you know, you've got strong matriarchs. You know, I had a great aunt called Machine Gun Molly in the East
That's
End,
fantastic.
Who the men were all terrified of. And another one, I never met her, but she was called Sarah Portugal, also a widow, wore a slash of red lipstick and smoked a cigar. And the men were absolutely terrified of her, because these women were tough and strong, and they knew how to cut deals, and they knew how to, you know, run businesses. And in the absence of any men, these women were tough. And the stories, again, that I grew up with was my great-grandmother and my grandmother and my uncle, our great-uncle Alf, who all called England the Golden Medina, because nobody wanted to behead or rape you here. But then they come face to face on the streets of Cable Street with Oswald Mosley, who had got married at Hitler's house to Diana Mitford. Honestly, Sam, every time anyone goes on about the glorious Mitfords, I want to scream, because there wasn't a dictator that those women didn't like. Diana Mitford got married to Mosley at Goebbels' house with Hitler as a witness, and Hitler gave Mosley the playbook of whipping up Jew hatred in order to take a big working class chunk with you and to gain power. But on this particular day at the Battle of Cable Street, having really whipped up the hatred, all the other working class communities in the area, the Irish, the working class English, the unionists, the dockers, the small Afro-Caribbean community, they all pulled together and said, if you come for the Jew, you come for us all. And they all linked arms, and they all threw marbles, and they all threw rubbish, and they turned over milk floats, and they saw them off. And basically, it was a real moment of unity. And that is the way, is the message of what I'm doing with my Shylock and this play, is to say that we are all better together and stronger together and prouder together when we fight a greater enemy, rather than people who want to pit us against each other.
Totally. I mean, you've never lacked for guts, let's be honest, but it does take guts to play Shylock, doesn't it? Because Shylock, however you play her, him, it's not a likable character.
Well, yeah, I mean, nobody, you know, I think I can definitely say this isn't a vanity project. This is an absolute project. You know, nobody wakes up and thinks, all my life, you know, you always get asked, what would you like to play? And, you know, people in Shakespeare, and people go, oh, Cleopatra or Beatrice. Nobody says, I'm really desperate to play Shylock. But I always, I wanted to take this play, and I wanted to reinvent it. And we've done an incredible schools project package so that it can be taught properly in schools. And also, we've done a great online world, and we've worked very closely with Stand Up to Racism as well, to go into younger schools and also community projects to talk about racism, anti-Semitism, and standing up against the greater evils of both hard right and hard left politics. So it does take guts in a way, but this play, I think the thing with Shylock, he's either I can only think of her as a she. She's either a victim or a villain. And I've seen productions where they've taken out all the words that potentially puts her into a villain, you know, the idea of revenge or wanting that pound of flesh. You know, I've seen it where they've really stripped back any of the words that make her a villain. And I've also seen productions where, so she's a pure victim. And I've also seen productions where she's a pure villain. And, you know, there are no pure victims and there are no pure villains. So I've been really honouring the text. And I've tried to make her, at best, a living, breathing, understandable immigrant woman who's faced enormous anti-Semitism, has had to be stronger than strong. I mean, also, Sam, remember, I mean, I think, you know, I've spoken to lots of friends of mine who are also from, you know, minorities, whose mothers and grandmothers and aunties came over here from strong matriarchal backgrounds. And particularly in the 30s, these tough women that could strap a cow over their shoulders, walk across a village, cut a deal with a local, you know, butcher from the village who wasn't Jewish, come back, turn the hovel into a palace on Friday night, fight Cossacks, hide your children from the Russian army who wanted to take them from the age of 7. I mean, these women were strong. And then the very things that made them survive, they came over to England, where in the 30s, you know, your women were to be decorative and quiet and passive and attractive and know their place. And these, so these women were an anathema. And in my personal experience of standing up to anti-Semitism, I have found that misogyny and racism, there's a massive interlocking of the two, because if you hate women, you certainly hate women who have got guts and balls and aren't afraid to speak out and won't go away when you tell them to.
Yeah, you certainly hate a woman who won't shut up, don't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Doesn't know their place. That's the thing. If you're not like decorative and quiet, what even are you?
Exactly. You're a foreigner. Get out. Yeah.
Those women that you were talking about, those amazing matriarchs, and I've already, Machine Gun Molly, I would say, how could I possibly forget that? That's brain fog for you. How did being brought up with those women, how did that affect you?
I think it made me, I never was brought up in a world where women were second place to men at all. And all credit to my grandfathers and uncles and my dad. It always felt that I could do anything, that the most important thing wasn't whether you were a man or a woman, but it was actually education. Education was the key to everything. Education could get you out of the slums. And if you had a, you know, if you could educate yourself, then that was the way out. So then it was open for everyone. So that was, I was always basically told, educate yourself and do better than the last generation.
So how did wanting to be an actress go down?
Really badly, really, really badly. I mean, it was just, they used to laugh at me. I mean, I do think, is it Shirley Winters who said, when you're born, a fairy flies over your crib and she says, you're going to be a nurse, you're going to be a teacher, you're going to be a lawyer. And she said, and if you're really unlucky, the fairy says, and you're going to be an actor. That's how she saw it. And I do think that a little bit like being an activist, I think actors are born, not made. I think you've got to want to do it so much against such odds. But my, you know, no immigrant family who originated from the Pale of Settlements want to hear their child saying, oh, I want to be an actor or an actress. You know, it was just, you might as well say you wanted to be an astronaut. There was no security in it. I think their attitude was only children of actors and actresses get to work in as actors and actresses. How are you from Stanmore, Middlesex, going to end up being an actor? Don't be ridiculous. Go to university, try and get to university, which I did. So they weren't very happy about it. And then when I left and I got into, I did 4 years at uni and then I went to drama school. And my dad was, this is ridiculous because that's another three. And again, I paid for all of it. It was, I funded myself through it. My dad was like, at the end of that, I did another 3 years. My dad was literally going, you've done 7 years of education. You could have been a doctor. Yes. What are we going to do?
You've been something proper, Trace.
Proper. And exactly, oh my God, how his exact words, Sam, were, if you insist on going down this route, quote, if you insist on going down this route, you are going to live the rest of your life in a bedsit with a cat for company. And every day I'm not doing that, I feel like I'm winning at life. Sam. But yeah, I was very, like, I was, you know, I remember getting a voiceover for After Eight the day after I left, which was funded me, ka-ching, so I could turn around and go, see, I'm not asking anybody for anything. Yeah. And then about a few weeks after that, I got a contract with the Royal Shakespeare Company for 4 years. So I never looked back, really. I never stopped working.
You've always refused to sit in a box, haven't you? And I think, I mean, now that might be all right. I don't know. Is it all right? I don't know. But certainly back then, I mean, I think you and I are like exactly the same age. So this would have been what, the mid-80s-ish, late 80s? Well, yeah, if you did 7 years education, like maybe 90. It's kind of, people wanted to know what to do with you, didn't they? It's like, okay, you go there and stay there. Don't budge.
I think that's really true. I think that I always wanted to explore every aspect of this industry, particularly when I started out around 91, which is when I finally left education, got a proper job, 91, 92. You were either, you know, I did quite a few years at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and then you were seen as a stage actor. Actually, you know what, Sam? I'm going to reclaim actress, because Dorothy Parker always said, scratch an actor and you get an actress. So in my opinion, we're all actresses. So it was, you know, I was very much seen as a stage actress and a classical stage actress. And it was really hard to be seen for television. And then I remember I got my first job in doing a TV sitcom, a comedy. And then after a few years, I was only seen as a television actress. And the idea then that you wanted to write, or you wanted to write comedy, or you wanted to write radio plays, or you, so it wasn't seen. You couldn't be a Renaissance woman. And I think that was something that I always was a little bit ahead of my time on, because I did refuse to be put into a box. So at the same time as doing loads of voiceovers, I was also on the radio rep. I was also doing lots of television. I was also doing some writing stand-up. So I was trying to do everything and explore every area to see how it would work. Whereas nowadays, I think it's much more, it's less binary. I think you can be lots of different things. In fact, it's expected that you would be lots of different things. So now I feel like everything's caught up. So I produce, I write, I create, I, you know, act, I make projects happen, and, you know, write radio plays, voiceovers, narration, all of that stuff. But it was much harder back in the day to sort of be able to explain how you wanted to do it all and how you could do it all.
Was that drive to be so versatile and to do everything, was that about never hitting a wall, do you think?
I think that if you've got, there's a creative, I think I've got a very creative brain, and it moves very, very quickly, and I get bored very quickly, and I'm always creating. I don't know whether I'm an undiagnosed ADHD. I don't know what it is. No. Very fun. Do you think we all are?
Yeah, I think, you know what, I think there are a lot, definitely. Practically every stand-up comedian I talk to has just been diagnosed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's interesting. Well, I definitely think my brain like works at 100 miles an hour, and I'm always ideas and making, so I can run like 3 or 4 projects. You know, I'll get up and I'll write a radio play at the same time learning my lines, at the same time I'm in the West End doing Noises Off, at the same time I'm, you know, also doing a narration till 12 at night. So that I just think, number one, that's how I'm wired and I get bored quite quickly. But number two, you know, I remember when I was in EastEnders and I loved it. It was really exciting. But there was a feeling of being slightly trapped in the same job and ultimately doing the same scene again and again. And for me, that wasn't the creativity that I was craving. And I think it's always about learning new stuff, doing new stuff, just being in the same holding pattern. Never doesn't feel creatively fulfilling to me.
Yeah. Do you drive your agent mad?
Well, I create a lot of my own work. So I've got lots of friends who are my age, who are all, you know, actresses and actors, but it's like you know, in The Fair, there's like a big claw that comes down and picks up a soft toy.
Like in Toy Story.
Exactly.
The claw.
And it sometimes feels that everybody's like waiting, looking at the claw and waiting for the claw to come down and pick them up and take them. And then they give them a job and then it pops them back into the pool again. And it's a really passive and helpless place to be. Some people don't mind it. I like being in the pool, looking up at the light, pick me, and waiting for the claw to come down. And that's really exciting. But it also, it puts you in a really, if you're a creative person and you've got things to say and you've got things you want to explore and stories that you want to tell and things that you haven't seen that you wanted to say make happen. It's sort of, as I got more confident and older, I realized, well, I should just try and make those things happen for myself. I want to be the change that I haven't seen. So I wanted to put on stories and tell stories and write things that interested me. So I think I probably, maybe early on, but nobody, I've got a lot of friends who are agents. So I do understand the game of being an agent. It's like being an estate agent, really, isn't it? There's only so many times you can put the same property up on the window, but just with different, but, you know, I'm not denigrating it, but ultimately, you know, you're selling people, you're selling talent. So there's only so much that they can do. They can't make somebody. Well, you know, you've got to work with your agent. See, you've touched a soft spot there.
Yeah, obviously.
Do I bother my agent? But I think I'm quite a good client because I get the industry in all its totality. So I know it isn't just a case of bringing your agent. You've got to try and, you work hand in hand with your agent to try and make things happen.
Has the making your own project and increasingly writing your own scripts, has that grown as you've got older? Because one of the things I notice with very many of the women who've come on the shift is they kind of say, I got to this point, I looked around, I couldn't see any opportunities, and I thought, well, I'm just going to have to make my own.
I think I've been very lucky in that I've always worked. I think my work ethic is, you know, I've never had big periods of unemployment. And I think that's because I diversified into lots of different areas and it's been very good. I think I always wanted to write and I was always given opportunity. You know, I was always asked earlier on in my career, oh, you're really funny, or you can write, will you do something? And I never had the confidence to do it. I was always very nervous and frightened, and I'd start projects and never see them through. But I honestly think becoming a mum, like at 39, quite late, having never held a child, never picked one up, I'd never changed a nappy, I was, you know, really slightly like, oh, what do I do with this? But when I was really good at being a mum, as well as working, I went back into the theatre after 4 months, but I just keep nurturing this child and keeping her alive and sort of being able to, I know this probably sounds a cliche, but it just gave me enormous confidence. And I thought, well, you know, if I can do that job, and I'm doing okay at it, I'm going to write a script and see what happens. I met a woman I've been working with on radio called Liz Anstey, who's brilliant, who came to see me in a play and said, you should write a play for me, write down some ideas. So I literally jotted a few ideas out on the back of an envelope, gave it to her. And she rang me 4 weeks later and said, oh, I've got you a commission. I was like, oh my God.
Wow.
That was my first radio play. And that was when, you know,
she. Then you had to do it.
Then I had to do it. It was like homework. And normally in the past, I would have just left it. And like, you know, I've had commissions again in my 20s and 30s that I just was crippled with fear of, you know, going back, delete. And this one, I just wrote, and then I had, and it went really well. And then it's just given me the confidence. I don't know. I think the thing is, Sam, age, people say aging is frightening for women. I think it gives us confidence. I think when we achieve things that we didn't think we could achieve and things that didn't come easy, you know, I could be in a play. I certainly couldn't cook a roast chicken or keep a child alive or do a school run and be able to. So all these like mundane things that I'd never even been interested in, I found I could do those, and I found those really hard. And then it gave me confidence to do the creative stuff as well.
Yeah, it's like the more you do and the more you live through and the more you survive, the more you know you can.
Actually, and the more you're not frightened of, I think as women, we're trained to live in fear of being disliked and for people not liking our work. I think that's what we're really inbred in us, not for people to not like our work or to say no. And I think when you can get over that fear and say, well, that's all right, you don't have to like it, but I like it, so I'm going to now take it somewhere else and see what they say. I think when we can get over the fear of not being liked all the time, I think it's a huge... And also, you know, the idea of being ambitious or being or speaking up for yourself or being, oh, I hate this word, pushy, whatever the hell that means. It's just like, if you believe in yourself and you believe in your work, push away.
Yeah, it's those words, isn't it? It's like, oh, you're outspoken or you're pushy or, you know, those, they're words that are always applied to women.
You never hear them applied to men. They're ambitious. You can be ambitious as a man. You can be passionate as a man. You can be fiery as a man. And these pejorative words are attached to women, and it's so boring. And we have to be, you know, we have to be the change that we want to see, and we have to be the change to show the younger generation that they've got us, you know, in the minute you hear those words. I once had a director do this to me, literally went, and I went, oh, sorry. And I went, are you shutting me down? And he went, I can't do actors that ask questions. I just, So I got my coat and I walked to the door and I said, I tell you what, when you've worked out where you want me to stand, call me back in 2 weeks and just put me in those positions. And he went, what do you mean? I said, well, that's obviously what you want. You just want to meet puppet, put the puppet in the positions, and then just call me back in the room. And I think that's what a lot of people would, men would want to do.
Yeah.
Whereas creativity should be a collaborative thing. You know, it's a collaboration of different skills and talents.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always wary of generalizing, but my experience is that things tend to be much more collaborative in that situation.
I hate a generalization, and I'm thinking in my head, am I generalizing? And I'm thinking about it and I'm thinking, no. No, I'm not.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
And there's this kind of this thing, isn't there, about it's like a woman always has to be a role model. Do you know, it's like, so you take Madonna and it's like, oh, she's such a bad role model. She's like this, that, and the other. And then you, like, nobody says that about Mick Jagger. But at the same time, do you feel like there is a bit of a responsibility as an actress in her mid-50s to, like you say, be the person who shows younger actresses that it's not all over? You don't go straight from the love interest to...
Driving Miss Daly. Do I feel like a role model? No, where I do feel like a role model is I've stood up, I stand up. You know, again, in this industry, everybody is so terrified because we're all self-employed. Everybody's so scared to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, be on the wrong side of whatever the political acceptance of the rehearsal room is, or the, you know, people are very nervous to step out of line. And I think it's very important that if you can't be creative, if you are living in fear. And so I think what I try and do is, because I'm old enough, because I'm older, and I think it's important to turn around and go, no, if something does feel wrong, stand up and say it. You've got to say it. Otherwise, what has changed in the world? You know, everybody talks about, oh, you know, it's so much more equal now. It's so, well, no, it isn't. Because if we're all still, as women, young women, coming into a room thinking, I'm frightened, I don't want to stick my head above the parapet, I've got to, you know, just sort of watch the room, I've got to see where the leader is, I've got to follow that leader, I've got to follow, it's not right. So in my activism, let's say, about identity, a lot of younger Jewish actors, for example, you know, I was very, you know, will always, you know, a big thing came up recently because a lot of people were scared to say they were Jewish, and they would hide their Star of David if they had them on inside their tops when they'd go into a rehearsal room, because they didn't want to get, you know, effectively pinned up against a wall within 2 minutes and asked about their opinions on Israel. And I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right. You wouldn't pin any other minority actor up against the wall within 2 minutes and say, what's your opinion on the Uyghurs? Or what's your, you know, so it's things like that, that I feel so passionate about saying that there has to be equality for all, that we have to stop living in fear. These things that I feel I can be a role model about.
Yeah, it's so interesting that, you know, the play is set in the 30s and it does feels a little bit precarious, doesn't it? It feels like populism is coming back, the right is on the rise. It's very cyclical. So the timing is interesting.
Well, there was a review, which I loved. One of the reviews said, written in the 1500s, set in the 1930s, absolutely relevant to 2023. History, you know, what did they say? The past predicates the future, Sam. And, you know, we're living in economically huge insecurity, globally massive insecurity. There's a war raging that's having a massive global impact, socioeconomic pulling apart, a sense of nationalism, a lack of tolerance for others, the idea of blaming others for our loss. It is like there is a loud warning bell. And when I'm going through headlines and newspapers and news reports of the 1930s, it's really chilling to see the similarities of some of the vernacular that we're using today.
Yeah, it really is.
We have to be vigilant.
Those amazing matriarchs who brought you up, how did they affect, do you think, your own approach to aging, how you felt about it?
Oh, my grandmother, Grandma Faye, even on her deathbed, wore lipstick. You know, it's a very European sensibility. You know, they were poor as, you know, they were so poor. A lot of them went into the schmutter trade, into tailoring. A lot of them were tailors and a lot of them were carpenters. So my grandmother and my great grandmother, they were called piece workers. They would sew, they would take the clothes home from the factories and they'd sew them. They absolutely understood in an Alexander McQueen-like precision the basis of a good cut and good quality material. So my grandmother would have one suit and one coat and one pair of shoes, but they were the best. It was about the quality, not the quantity. And it was about, it didn't matter if the worst thing had gone on, you know, you at home. I think my other grandma, I remember, you know, whatever happened to you at home, you could be crying and sobbing. The minute you walked out that door, you'd powdered your face and you'd put a little bit of lipstick on. And that was your mask. That was your strength against the world. So I think this idea of it's a very European. I see it amongst Italian and Spanish friends of mine and their grandma. That idea of sort of glamour was, you know, you always had your nails done, even though you probably couldn't afford to buy vegetables. Like I said, you know, you had one pair of shoes, but they were an amazing pair of shoes. That one coat was so beautifully cut and you always wore lipstick. So I think that sort of probably affected me, which is you put on your war paint when you go out, no matter how awful you feel.
Yeah, you always put your face on. But also the kind of power of those women, it doesn't sound like there was any diminishing power as they got older.
You know, when you look at the women in the Second World War who fought in the munitions factories, and when the men were away, took over running the country, basically, you know, for the first time, these women were tying their hair back and were workers and were in charge of things and given a real sense of responsibility. And then after the war, these women were then sent back to the kitchens, and all their immediacy and all their power was taken away from them, and how hard that must have been. I think a lot of the matriarchs that I grew up with, they had power in the East End when they were younger because they were widows and they were running the schmutter business or the money, you know, whatever they were doing. But as they got older into their 50s and maybe had moved out of the East End and had moved more into the suburbs, and they were kind of reduced, but they fought side by side with their men to build up those businesses. And then I did feel a little sense of frustration. Me and my friend Claire always talk about the women, you know, frying fish and chips in their little house in Hendon, and thinking, wow, that woman was fighting black shirts and getting up every morning and at the market stalls in Watling Street and, you know, making things happen. And they were all very politically active and really politically motivated. And I wonder in their 50s and, you know, 60s, 70s, if they had become more domesticated and if they enjoyed that.
You didn't ever get to ask them, I suppose.
Well, I don't think, you know, I wish I had. My gosh, you know, they say that youth is wasted on the young. When I think of my great-grandmother who I knew, who'd come out of Belarus, and she was with us till she was 92, and my grandmother, I used to listen to the stories and pick them up, but I would love to be able to sit with them. I mean, gosh, if I could have anything, it would be to sit with those women now and say, what was that journey like at 14? What was it like living in a factory floor? What was it like being part of starting the labour movement in the End? You know, my great-grandfather apparently was Trotsky back in, and knew him and ended up being part of the Russian Revolution. You know, those stories, you think, I wish I'd listened to those stories.
It's such a waste, isn't it? You just think, oh God, just to have a couple of hours asking all those questions.
Yeah. What did you have strong matriarchs in your family?
Not so much, I don't think. I mean, one of the things that I always think about, my gran on my dad's side just had babies after babies.
Wow.
And my mum's mum was, I think, a very dissatisfied woman. And I think one of the things I often think when you look back at those generations and the way that their lives were lived, it wasn't really about choice, was it? It wasn't about deciding whether or not to have children or deciding, you know, whether or not to get married. Often, you know, marriage was a way out. It was a way of survival. So I think I actually would love to talk to them, particularly my mum's mum, about what she really wanted. What in a different, you know, in a different time she would have, how she would have lived her life. And I think that goes for loads of older women, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes, definitely. I think one of the things is when you're living hand to mouth and survival, there is a certain freedom, because the freedom is you do anything to survive and you do anything to try and better yourself. In some ways, it's quite a middle class luxury to be able to think, what are my choices? What choice do I want? I don't think they even thought like, I don't think they thought like that. I think it was just a case of you were working, had an energy and a passion and a desire to sort of give your children the opportunity that you didn't have, and to get on up and get on out.
Yeah, totally. You were paying the rent and bringing the kids up and surviving. Yeah. And that was as far as it went.
And often, I don't know about in your, but I know that, you know, when I think about those EastEnders and what it was, what it must have been like, you know, they were equal. Those men and women did, you know, they would, you'd sort the kids out, you know, it took a village to raise a child. Your auntie next door or the neighbour next door would look after the babies. You literally had to get up at 6 a.m, get to the market stall, pull it down, get all the things out, get those new Levi jeans that you were the first person to bring into England. You know, there was a hunger. That's not to glamorise it, because the slums were awful. But I'm talking about it a lot because I've been, you know, I'm sort of dwelling so much into it for this project. So it's been kind of interesting.
But it's really interesting because it's obviously massively shaped you.
I hadn't realised how much it had, but I do think I won't be cowed. I will not, you know, I will not be, I'm not intimidated easily and I don't frighten easily. And I think those women were very much a part of that.
Do you feel like now you're into your 50s, have you grown into yourself, do you think?
Definitely, definitely. I can honestly say I think my 40s and 50s, and my 40s and my coming up to my mid-50s has really been the time of my life. I think I found a voice. I think I'm less concerned about the observations of others or caring what others think. Ultimately, you can't, you know, I don't like everybody, so why should I expect everybody to like me? There's a freedom in that. And also just realising how fantastic women are. You know, you go into a party, you know, these days, if I can be bothered to go to a party.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it?
God, FOMO is everything. I mean, what do they call it? It's not fear of missing out. It's the desire to miss out.
Yeah, joy of missing out.
Yeah, the JOMO, exactly. Oh, nothing better than being in bed at 10 o'clock. But, you know, if you do go into a party, it's often, who is that woman, that older woman in the amazing shoes or the amazing glasses? She looks like, you know, the company of women is brilliant. Women are brilliant.
It's just so interesting you say that, because I was talking to someone else about that thing that does come with invisibility, the so-called invisibility from the male gaze, if you want, for a better way of putting it, that the kind of obverse, is obverse the right word? Of that is that you start to become really visible to women, the older women. And it's like, it's almost like being part of a club. But also, I don't know whether, I mean, I always hated trying to make friends with people when I was younger. I found it really hard. I didn't really know what I was meant to be doing. But it's much, much easier when you're older, because it's almost like you just cut through.
Absolutely.
All of the crap.
I could never do small talk. And I'm loving it. Really, nobody does small talk these days. About, you know, like you meet really interesting people who just want to cut to the chase. But, you know, it's funny you talk about the being, you know, being invisible. Quite a few of my friends in their early 50s have got divorced. Well, their husbands have left them. And far from being invisible, they're just getting all these young men after them.
But the crucial bit is young.
Oh, yeah.
It is. That's the crucial bit. I hear this so often.
That's unbelievable. Men. What do you think? Why? Why do you think that is?
Oh, God, I don't know. I don't know if it's... Well, I've heard different theories from different people. I was interviewing someone first thing this morning who's boyfriend is, or lover as we call him, is 13 years younger than her. I've got another friend whose boyfriend's good 10 years younger than her. I think it's, I mean, I don't think they even know what Mrs. Robinson syndrome is, because most of them are too young. But I think there's also a slight generational thing where they're just up for it, and they're up for trying. And also a lot of them, they're not thinking about having kids. They're not interested in having kids. The number of women I've spoken to who've been like, oh my God, middle-aged men on dating sites, they only want to date women who are 20 years younger than them. And if you are unlucky enough to go on a date with them, they're really bloody boring.
Whereas I'm here, yeah, and these friends of mine, and obviously, Stacey, who's do good.
Yes.
Yes. So was it still okay? So I was reading Stacey's thing in the I don't know her, but I was I've been following her on Instagram, and
yeah,
say hello from me. I'm a big fan, but she seems to represent a sort of real archetype at the moment of these women that are suddenly liberated and find. So a lot of my friends are on these are on sites and meeting younger men who are saying dating in their 20s with 20 and 30 year olds is a minefield of coded. Codes that they don't understand and that they don't they're a bit scared of, but they're saying there's a real liberation in older women or women that are older than them, because there's a, you know, you mean what you say. There's nothing to sort of have to navigate through. It's just uncomplicated and freeing and sexy and open and gorgeous. And that made me think, wow, that's brilliant.
Tempting.
No, I love my hobby. Yeah, I haven't got the energy apart from anything else.
No.
It's always it's nice to know you could, but go home for a cup of tea.
Yeah.
Have a cup of tea in a box set.
Oh, God, always, yeah. So what's that? Where have you been with menopause? You had it?
Do you know, my mum was one of those mums. She had me and my sister very young. She was like 20 by the time she had me and my sister. She was like, as she always says, she was like, I always think of that scene in Stardust Memories when Woody Allen's sitting on this really grey train and then suddenly a train goes by and it's a party train and everybody's like whooping and snogging and having a fun. And I always think my mum missed that party train. She just got there. She just got pregnant and married at 19, just before the 60s revolution started. So my mum, whenever I would say to my mum, oh, you know, what was pregnancy? Oh, can't remember, darling. You know, what was it? What was menopause? Oh, I don't remember. You know, yeah. did you have a menopause? I think so. Can't remember. I have turned into that woman because I think I had a menopause, but it was other than being, I can't say, there's nothing I can even say on it. I don't think I was any grumpier, more irrational or more, maybe a little bit hotter. I know nothing specific that I can share on this one.
No, brilliant.
My tolerance levels, which were already at the lowest ebb that they ever were, are now so far down that I'm thinking that might be tired, very tired. But then I think that's probably because I do too much. Didn't particularly have the hot flushes. No, nothing particularly other than literally just female rage.
To think I used to like you as well.
Sorry. But that's quite, and I never took anything.
Wow.
Although for maybe impressive. No, nothing. Why? Could it have been horrendous? Tell me.
Well, no, it could. I can't tell you because we haven't got time because I'm watching the clock now. But it could have been, but it wasn't. So that's great.
Yeah. Maybe it was, and I've just got a really high tolerance threshold. Maybe it was. I think my main symptom, if I have one, is massive impatience. That's terrible, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that could be. No, I just think you get to a point where you're just like, oh, cut to the chase.
Oh, I'll do it. Oh. Give it to me. God. I'll do it. Here's the thing. This might be useful if we're talking about the menopause. I thought I was going through hot flushes. And then I went to see a doctor who was very loath to put me straight onto HRT. And we did some investigations and it turned out I had a low thyroid. So she put me on thyroxine knocked it on the head.
I've heard that before. That's interesting. So I'm going to ask you the questions that we always ask the end, and then we'll do them as quickfire as we can. So what's your emotional age?
I think I was probably 50 at 15. I don't know. I just feel like a 15-year-old girl. I don't know. I can't say anything. That just came from somewhere deep inside of me and I have no justification for it.
Give us a book recommendation.
Random Acts of Senseless Violence by Jack Womack.
Interesting. I think we've got that somewhere. I haven't read it, but definitely.
So I love sci-fi and I love dystopian fiction. And weirdly, through Twitter, the early days of Twitter, I became very friendly with Jack, who was my cult favourite sci-fi writer. I love a bit of Vonnegut and I love all that stuff. I'm rereading 1984 as we speak. But this Random Acts of Senseless Violence, which was written in the 80s, just really captured a dystopian view of the world through a young girl whose family life and life around her is imploding in New York in a dystopian future. It's really prescient.
It's fascinating. What advice would you give younger women?
You don't have to be liked.
Who is your old bird role model?
Iris Apfel, but she's probably everybody's.
She's not actually, but she's a good choice. What's your superpower?
sniffing out bullshit.
And how many fucks do you give?
A day or generally?
Generally, whatever you like.
Probably give 3 fucks a day. And like really important things. When am I going to eat next? When am I going to... I think probably overall in life, I give 5 fucks. Generally, those are my 5 fucks. And it will take a lot to push me off those 5 fucks. How many fucks do you give a day, Sam?
Do you know what? It changes all the time. Every time somebody asks me this question back, probably less than I did and more than I should. And it varies from day to day.
You have to discipline ourselves on the fuck factor because it can drain you, can drain us of our energy.
Totally.
Lovely to see you, Sam.
Thank you, Tracy Ann. Lovely to see you.
See you soon, I hope.
Yep. Back to your rehearsals. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, you might also like my conversations with Minnie Driver and Sheila Hancock. You'll find a link to them and all the remaining dates for the Merchant of Venice 1936 tour in the show notes. You can hear a new episode of The Shift each Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please do rate, review and follow, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like more of The Shift in your life, head over to theshiftwithsambaker.substack.com and sign up for weekly newsletters, podcast extras, and more.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.